I'm really happy to welcome Nahid Anga. We've been friends for a long time, and she's someone that I respect a great deal. She's a recognized leader in the modern Sufi movement and one of the first modern women to gain that stature. She's the daughter of Maulana Shah Maqsood, who's a revered Sufi scholar and poet of one of the most influential Persian branches of the tradition. She is the co-founder and head of the International Association of Sufism, and in that connection, she also heads the Sufi Women Organization. She's a veteran of the global interreligious movement, I'll be talking to her about that a little bit, and a champion of the rights of women in Islam and around the world, and she's the author of many books, but including, among them, White Fire, A Portrait of Women Spiritual Leaders in America, and another, Women in Sufism, A Hidden Treasure. So this is a treasure to welcome you here today, Nahid. Let me just say a word, Barbara, if that's appropriate, about the larger topic.
Mm-hmm.
And what we wrote for the site is this. I'll just read it to you. Sufism is the mystical tradition of Islam. And we're going to be talking today, by the way, about peace and the Sufi heart. The mystical tradition of Islam, while it has influenced every Muslim culture since its rise not long after the time of Muhammad, Sufism has had a particularly rich connection to Persian literature and culture. Jalaluddin Rumi, the great 13th century Sufi poet, is widely regarded as a master of Persian literature and one of the greatest spiritual teachers of all time. Just before we joined the call, we were commenting on the fact that he has been, for a number of years, the best-selling poet in the United States, which probably, as Fatima, one of our panelists, pointed out, that probably makes him the most read poet in the world. It's often suggested that one of the most important tensions in the Muslim world exists between the spiritual path of the Sufis and the rigid orthodoxy of some legal scholars. And the countless Sufi orders have exerted a powerful influence over hundreds and hundreds of years in the development of Islam. So it should be an interesting conversation.
Oh, great.
Thank you so much.
Jump in.
Okay, so let's have it, yeah. Nahid, welcome again. And you've been involved in, as I pointed out in your little bio, you've been involved in the global interreligious movement for many years. That's how we met. Can you tell us why it's important to you and tell us about a particularly memorable experience you've had along the way, along that path?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for inviting me to this forum and also for doing all these acknowledgments for our diversities. Now, it is important to understand that religion is a fundamental player in shaping nations. And it's very important, plays such an important role in cultures, civilizations, and so forth. So one of the important issues is that if people of religions and the spiritual pursuit come together in the spirit of understanding and friendship, and if we learn to honor and respect each other's traditions and diversities, then we will have a better chance in working together towards peace and understanding. We will be able to promote human rights through friendship and respect, and that has been one of my important experiences in the movement of inter-religion, religious movement, because when we become to that point of friendship and respect, we actually open the line and dialogue amongst one another. So, with this have in mind, that has been one of the reasons that I have been involved and I have also served in interreligious movement and interfaith dialogue. Because through this dialogue, not only I'll learn, people will learn from me and I will learn from them, I develop some kind of friendship, and through friendship, actually, we develop respect. And when we develop respect, we honor each other's ideas. So we appreciate our similarities. At the same time, we respect our differences rather than fight over them. One of my most memorable experiences is that I had a few years ago. It was through actually Sufi Women Organization. And of course, Sufi Women Organization is an international organization. It is not only open to Sufis, it is open to spiritual women throughout the world, but it is not open to the public. It is just a private conversations among people of spirituality around the world. Many years ago, I don't know if you remember, there was a riot in Indonesia, and we had several of our members in Indonesia. And as soon as we began to learn about a riot in the Indonesia through media, the entire dialogue became bombarded with all kinds of questions and worrisome. So you would hear, in reality, you would hear and you would feel the voice of concern throughout the world. Everybody was concerned about these women. So it took them about 2 days until they responded to the rest of the world or this dialogue that they were okay. But one of these women had his son in the protest and she didn't know what was happening to him. So in reality, every woman around the world within that dialogue began to feel whatever she was going through. And you could actually hear their sighs and their worriness through the language. So finally she found the son. The son was okay. And as soon as the son was okay and we heard the news, it seems that every mother around the world had that sigh of happiness. So finally my son, who was somebody else's son, was at home safe and sound. So what that told me was that it was through that communication and respect and creating a respectful family around the world, whether there's a religion or no religion, it actually goes beyond borders and tradition. It connects to the human heart. And that is what I think the world needs now. The world needs human connection. The world needs human heart. The world needs to connect to our human family so we can hear, so we can feel each other's feelings and each other's needs and each other's pursuit. Without there, I think we all become politicians, and politicians are politicians. And that's a whole different story to it.
Well, that's
so
a,
interreligious
that's a fantastic
movement
story.
That is done, that is contributed by the people who actually go back to the human heart and they honor human family is a valuable movement. And it had taught me a lot, and it had created so much friendship, international friendship for me. And I see many people who actually serve the communities and many communities around the world. So it goes beyond borders and traditions.
Well, talking about the heart makes a perfect introduction. That was a beautiful story. To the next question, which simply has to do with the fact that you are, of course, a leader in the international Sufi community, but can you tell us all and all our listeners on the call a little bit more about Sufism and about your work with and on behalf of other Sufis? And along the way, perhaps you'll give us a sense of how Sufism compares and perhaps contrasts with other mystical traditions. But tell us a little bit more about Sufism.
Well, you have mentioned about the history of Sufism. So I relate to that and I follow that. Sufism is the mysticism of Islam. And its history goes back to the Prophet of Islam, 7th century, to a group of people who used to sit on the platform of his mosque in Medina. We know that the Prophet of Islam, just like all the prophets before him and all the wonderful teachers who worked for humanity, they were pushed away from their own birthplace somehow, and they were not accepted by their own community under later time. So anyhow, he was moved or pushed away from Mecca to Medina. In Medina, he had a house, and he built a mosque next to the house. And the platform on that mosque, there were a group of people who were coming from different lands, not all from Arabia. They used to sit on the platform, and they would ask questions such as, "You say that you have an experience of God, so how can I have that experience so I know for sure? You talk about the direct understanding, so how I can have that awareness?" So they were not happy to following instructions or teaching. They actually wanted to get to the core of the teachings because words can go so far. You need, at some point, you need to get to the meaning of those words. So they began the practices such as meditation and purification and so forth. And since Islam is the religion of knowledge, and the pursuit of knowledge of the self became fundamental pursuit in the Sufi practice, So after the passing of the Prophet of Islam, many of these Sufis went back to their own homeland, and one of them was a Persian, and he went back to Persia. And over a period of time, he began to teach whatever he had learned, and his students began to teach whatever they have learned. And in reality, Persia became one of the major contributors to the movement of Sufism. And many, almost 95% of Sufi schools somehow relates to the Persian schools. And in 1983, my husband and I, Dr. Kianfer, founded International Association of Sufism. At some point, we thought it is a pity that all these Sufis from around the world who serve communities and they have so much information and so much knowledge and they can teach each other, it would be a pity if we remain separate from one another. So we have decided to found an international association through the not only through our own work but also through the efforts and contribution of many Sufi masters and Sufi schools around the world. Over a period of time, we began to publish a Sufism journal. And through that Sufism journal that was also distributed internationally, we introduced, again, Sufi masters, regardless of their schools, Sufi schools, their historical background, and the monuments, and architects, and ideology, and poetry from around the world. So we actually began to introduce Sufism in all its varied forms. And in 94, I organized Sufism Symposium. And to my knowledge, this was the first time in the history of Sufism, which is about 1400 years old, that so many Sufis from around the world and from different many schools came together in the spirit of harmony for one week conversation. And in reality, I wanted to have only one time. But then, as soon as we began to meet each other, nobody wanted me to stop. So now we are on our 18 years of Sufism Symposium, believe it or not. So we began to talk about practices, poetry, literature, philosophy, psychology, music, and it was a heart-to-heart conversation. We have learned so much from Sufis from around the world, from Malaysia all the way to West Africa. And it was a wonderful conversation. And through all these many years, we became friends with one another. So there were more conferences and more conferences, and the focal point was how you come to that point of self-awareness and self-knowledge that also provides you, actually promotes you to serve the community. Over time, through the human rights advocacy and many different kinds of advocacy, International Association of Sufism was admitted to the United Nations as an NGO and the Department of Public Information, and became one of the major contributors to the interreligious movement. And we ultimately established different departments, such as Sufi Psychology Department, Sufi Women, Voices for Justice, and Institute for Sufi Studies, and Building Bridges. So we came to a whole different kind of serving community. Now, when we talk about the differences between Sufism and other mysticism, we can loosely, if you want to study religion, we can loosely regard religion as its outer practice and its inner practice. And inner practice has been labeled as mysticism. And many religions have inner practice, and they have many different kinds of mysticism. And I think they all are talking to the core of the matter. They all go back to the actual teachings, and they are not stuck in the surface of words, which becomes the major point of our conflict. They go back to the heart of the matter, and when you go to the meaning, I think at that point, nobody has any conflict. And Sufism, as I said, is rooted to the Islam. So many of the practices are Islamic, but it does have different colors and different shapes because it was introduced to different cultures and different nations, and so it also had a little bit a color of the traditions and nations that it was embraced to. For example, there is some differences between African Sufis that they all come with those beautiful voices of singing and beautiful colorful clothing, and Indian Sufis who have musical, and their music and their chanting just mesmerize you. And to some of also Persian Sufis who become very intellectual into the matter, they all speak that language of heart. It's so many beautiful colors and so many different melodies. And that had become one of the most, my own personal contribution to Sufism, to open the line of dialogue between all these Sufis and introduce Sufism in all its varied form.
I'm just mesmerized by what you're saying, and I was reflecting on something you said before we joined the call when Barbara asked a question about the relationship of poetry to Sufism and why it's so strong. And I wonder if you'd just say just a word or two. We have lots of questions to get through, but just a word or two of what you said before about why poetry becomes so important in mystical traditions in general, but in Sufism in particular, it seems to be.
Well, one of the questions in religion is a question of God. And, you know, when you are a mystic, actually you dare to ask those questions because ultimately you are looking for answers. You don't just disregard and you don't just follow. One of the most important questions in religion is what is God? So we have, and there are so many varieties that we talk about, and we have disagreements and agreements and everything about God. The question, the reason is that probably the notion of God had remained hidden. Everybody has a definition of it. So we agree, we disagree. We develop so many different schools. We have talks, we have conflicts most likely, rather than agreement. But when you go to the heart of the matter, when you fall in love, it seems that love has an international, it is beyond borders language. When I say love, we all understand what I'm talking about, even though my beloved may be different from yours, or it has a different meaning, but ultimately we all understand this notion. It is not hidden, it is not mysterious, it is not confusing, it is just there. So, and what is the most beautiful language of love? It is poetry or music. And sometimes whatever is creative, and sometimes those beautiful paintings, everything that brings human being to that beautiful, beautiful silent nature, creative nature that lies in every cell of human beings. So when Sufis begin to talk about love, and the best language that they have is the language of poetry, in addition to the language of music. So that became the language of Sufism. And Sufis came to many nations, and they were all embraced by many nations simply because of this language of poetry. We may have debates on different ideas when it comes philosophical, but when the same thing comes in the language of poetry, it seems that we all agree because there is that longing within the human heart that none of us can deny. So that becomes the language of Sufism.
I should tell our listeners that on the website there's information and a bio of you, and we point out there that you are a poet, a published poet, and a translator of verse, and that your father, Maulana Maqsood, was a very revered Sufi poet in the one of the premier Persian schools. You're also, Nahid, very active on behalf of women in Islam and the larger world. And here's a trickier question, perhaps. How are the status and roles of women in Islam in particular changing today? And why is that so important?
Well, one thing that I have to mention before I answer the question is that sometimes people do not know that the Sufi women have been treated equally from the very beginning of time.
In the Sufi tradition.
They have been teachers, and they had the students, and the students, men and women. So they did hold to that role from the beginning. Now, gradually over the period of time, according to traditions and political systems of nations, things began to change. So Muslim women's rights is very much similar to the women's rights all around the world. You have the right, the God-given right is given to you, but you have to fight for it. It's just unbelievable.
That's not a right.
So you have to And it takes education. It actually takes education to understand that every human being is entitled to his or her own right. The gender and religion and social status should not prevent or give extra rights to people. Human beings, we all have been born equally. We all have been given that essence of life on an equal base. So then it comes governments, and then it comes authorities, and then it comes people, and they began to put us in different levels and different status and give this right to these people and that right to other people. And it has been a long history. Now, at the present time, there are lots of Muslim women movement all over the world. There are great organizations that they work for the rights of women, and there are many scholar women and spiritual leader women who actually take action, and they make sure that women would gain their legal right. It is not any other right, but it is a legal right that has to be given. When not given, it is legal rights that has to be honored by people who are a part of a nation. And I think probably when we talk about rights, we are not talking about any kind of right, but we only talk about legal rights. And that has become such an issue. But it has nothing to do with religion. That is something that I have to mention. It all depends to cultures, to political systems, to the likes and dislikes of the people in authority.
And I certainly think that's true of all the great religious traditions, that it's usually the flaw or the what we're trying to correct or improve or bring into focus has to do with the culture rather than with the tradition itself.
True, and I have many stories to tell you, but of course I am not going to tell you because sometimes, you know, it is a little bit tricky, and it is, you know. But you know,
we hear you.
Yeah, but the thing is that who gives another person the permission? Really, think about it. We have to think about that. Who gives another human being the permission to tell another human being what are your rights, or you have these or you don't have these? Who gives us that permission?
Well, so that
takes education. That takes education. It ultimately, we have to educate ourselves for this. We have to become a little bit more aware. I always ask this question, who gives another a human being the right, the permission to tell another human being that is not okay in my dictionary? Some people may not like it, but then again, we are all different.
Here's another difficult question that I think is not unrelated to this in general. At the moment in the United States, we're experiencing a very strong, very irrational backlash against Muslims. What do you think is the source? I'm going to just ask you several little things, and you can deal with whichever pieces of this you'd like. What do you think is the source? How are Muslims, Sufis included, responding to this challenge? And I'd just like to throw in also that I'm persuaded, and we've talked about this sort of thing in other calls, in terms of the rise of fundamentalism and so on, I'm persuaded that this backlash against Muslims will fade before too long. Do you agree, and why or why not? So lots of questions in there, but why don't you just take on what you'd like?
Okay. Yes, I agree with you that this is irrational. It means that propaganda has a stronger voice than rationale. That is one thing. And I always, you know, I teach at the university, and I teach Islam, and I teach, you know, things that are related to Islam. And I always tell them, if prejudice is not beneficial to you, the most important question is that you have to ask yourself who benefits from your prejudice. That is where the story lies. That is one thing. Second is that about almost, not exactly, but about one-third of the population of the world are Muslims. Okay. Now, labeling all of them and treating all of them that we know that they are coming from different cultures, different nationality, different national heritage, geography, historical background, all these, we put them all into one group of people. Understanding and knowing that nations, by just being nations, are different from one another. we just call them one group of people is truly based on our not knowing, and it is not really fair. So that is something that we have to change, and it takes education. And prejudice against Islam is not a new thing. It has a long, long history, believe it or not. It goes back to the 9th and 10th century, when Islam became a major voice of civilization. An Islamic empire that extended from India to Spain contributed to the advancement of science, to medicine, to astronomy, to all different kinds of disciplines, and it became one of the major contributors to the rise of Renaissance in Europe. So in reality, it became the major intellectual, religious, and economical threat to the fathers in Europe. And that is, these are not things that we can just overlook. That is what are facts. And Islam, being not a group religion, but a very individualistic kind of religion, and there is no hierarchy, it means that you really don't need any mosque or any church. So that would be another economical threat. So all these issues or these major facts contributed to a big problem. And what happens during that time, 9th and 10th century, because I actually taught this in my class through so many different books, was that there was an Orientalist expedition. They were people who were hired by the church, by the fathers in the church. They were sent to the Middle Eastern lands or some Islamic land. They bring back tainted information and disseminate that to the West against Muslims. And it continues to the present time. How many of those cartoons, when somebody is ugly and traitor and tyrant and difficult, is portrayed with a turban and sound like a Muslim? So that tainted information continued from 9th and 10th century, when Islam was in its highest point and Europe was going through the Dark Ages. It continued to the present time. So the story has a long history. It may or may not fade away. All depends. I'm hoping that it may fade away. The more that we educate ourselves, especially with the young generation, and especially at the time, at the age of internet, that all informations are going back and forth beyond borders. At some point, I'm hoping that when we receive our information, we have enough time to examine our information, one. And second, begin to educate ourselves. Not all Muslims can go under one umbrella. And you know, one thing is that there is no nation in the world, and there is no religion in the world that is innocent from destruction.
That's certainly true. Certainly true.
So at some point, we have to ask ourselves, why Muslims? So again, I go back to that point that I always tell my students. If prejudice does not benefit you, then you have to ask yourself, who benefits from my prejudice? That is where the answer is. Will it go away, fade away? All depends. Hopefully it will with the younger generation.
My hope is that something that feeds on ignorance and that virtually demands a narrow, isolated, enclave mentality is going to have a very hard time surviving in the 21st century. But as you say, it depends. Here's another related thing to talk about. What about what's going on in the Middle East? And I want to link that to another question about Iran. Let me do it backwards and say, of course, first of all, we're all very interested in the various risings in the Middle East. I think we're all more or less aware that they have very different character. What's happening in Egypt or Tunisia is different from what's happening in Libya or Yemen or now in Syria. But also Iran. And I have a very good friend that I'm sure is known to you, Professor Ahmed Sadri, who is from Tehran originally, and he likes to say that Iranian culture is the most secular culture in the world, by which he means something a little different from our normal usage. He means there the idea of the separation of mosque and state, or church and state, is stronger than in any other culture. You've already told us that this is a very spiritual culture with strong Sufi roots, but what's the likelihood of real ferment continuing there? And what's your take on the general ferment in the Middle East? It's a huge question, but I know you'll have something to tell us.
Well, you know, Middle East has been in the battleground for at least 50 or 60 years. goes along. And sometimes we label our interests in Middle East as humanitarian, for the sake of equality, democracy, and all these things. But in reality, it is the natural resources that attracts our attention. That is one thing that I have to say. At some point, people of the Middle East and maybe North Africa had enough, especially at this economy and global internet information. There are so many human rights movements in every corner of the world, East and West. So everything contributes to a movement. And what would be the result of these movements? That is something that I do not know. My biggest worry is that at some point we begin again to lose human lives, innocent people. It seems that we talk about, for example, global health and all these things, but you know, we have lost our take in the importance of human life. Who tells us, as I said, who gives us permission to destroy cultures and human beings and national heritage and all those things? And how and when our savagery would stop at some point? What would it take us to honor life rather than our self-righteousness permission to destroy? Whether it is inland in forces, outside in forces, it doesn't make any difference. As human beings, we spend so much time, for example, in the laboratory to find cures for illnesses or something like that. We take care of our youth, we take care of our elderly and all those things. But then again, we turn around and build weapons of mass destruction. So what is this story? It seems that human life has lost its importance, one thing. And when we go to Iran, well, actually, I have not been in Iran for a long time, so I really cannot say because I really don't know. I hear different points of view. So which one is which one? I have absolutely no idea. But your friend is absolutely right. Iranians are spiritual, but they are not so much dogmatic. They do not like rigidness. And that is not favorable to their taste. Iranian culture has a long history of spirituality, from Zoroastrian, which was a mystical religion, all the way to the present time, which is Sufism. And the spirituality is woven so much with the culture. So people do not like, people are not rigid. People are poets, people are musicians, people are cultured, people are open-minded. So at this point, they don't like something that is rigid. But then again, we go back to the religious law or any kind of law. My question is that who will interpret these laws? That is something that we have to understand. There are so many different schools in law in Sunnism. There are so many different schools of law in Shiism. So which one is the which one? And ultimately, who is the interpreter of all these laws? And for that, we, Iranians, including myself, we are not so much favorable of rigidness and dogmatic ideas. And ultimately, whatever is the law, religious or secular, who is interpreting them? That is why probably in every land we have so many lawyers and so many judges, so many agreements and disagreements, because everybody interprets law according to their own understanding. And what is more confusing than religion? There lies your answer.
It's amazing because with each question that you've answered, you've led right into the next one that I had in mind. And we're running low on time, and I'd like you to wind up after one more question. We were planning on inviting you to offer a blessing at the beginning, and we simply forgot to do that, but you were going to offer a poem, so I wonder if after this one more short question, you might want to favor us with that poem you had in mind. And here's the question that I've been asking every week from of each of our guests, so a brief response if possible, although it's a huge question again. We've been asking about the current struggle in the world between fundamentalism and religious pluralism, and asking which is likely to prevail in our time, fundamentalism or religious pluralism. I think you can guess what the most frequent answer has been from our guests, but we'd like to hear yours.
Okay, well, I'm not going to give you a long speech, but ultimately I go to one or two statements. The thing is that as long as religion, however form it has, becomes an enforcer rather than educator, there you have your problem. As long as the spirituality creates separation rather than honoring our diversities, there we have a problem. So whether it is fundamentalism, which is limiting, or religious pluralism, which is probably more focuses on respect, as soon as it becomes the voice of authority, you have problem right there. And then we have to begin from point zero.
So it doesn't matter
as long as there is an enforcer behind the voice, as long as there is an authority dictating to a group of people, we have problems. Whoever under whatever umbrella we have these.
Now there's a thought, authoritarian pluralism. There's an old story of God and the devil walking down the beach, and
yeah.
God bends over to pick up something shiny, and the devil says, "What is it?" And God says, "It's the truth." And the devil says, "Let me organize that for you."
There you have it.
Okay, well,
then I would like to end actually with a beautiful poem of Omar Khayyam, which is Rubaiyat, and of course I have the translator of this poem, but this poem is the heart of the matter, the fundamental practice in Sufism. And we have two you in this poem. One refers to God, another one refers to human being. So he says, "When I was young, my heart was searching for your, and you in here means God, for your tablet and pen, heaven and hell. The master called, the secret told, you." Here comes back to the human being. You are the heaven and hell, tablet and pen and all. So when I was young, my heart was searching for your tablet and pen, heaven and hell. The master called, the secret told. You are the heaven and hell, tablet and pen and all.